Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the Pantograph for Friday, June 19th, 2026. I'm going to start today with some local and state news, and then in the second half move to sports and... But I'm not sure we have any obituaries. I'm not seeing any. So I'm going to get started here with the front page. On the front, we have a beautiful picture of some Canada geese moving across Miller Park Lake in Bloomington on Thursday. And the caption reads, the migratory birds are known for returning to the same nesting sites year after year. There are three beautiful pictures there of those birds. And right there on the first... On the right-hand column of the paper, we have a story, top story focused on the Middle East with the headline, First Tankers Cross Strait. And this is a Reuters story with the subhead, Trump Signs Deal with Iran, Israeli Strikes Raise Doubt in Lebanon. And I'll begin. Three Saudi-flagged supertankers carrying 6 million barrels of crude sailed through the Strait of Hormuz on Thursday, hours after U.S. President Donald Trump signed a deal with Iran to end the war that disrupted global energy prices. But in Lebanon, where more than 1 million people are displaced by the fighting, Israeli forces launched fresh airstrikes on Thursday morning, raising doubt about how far Trump will go to force his wartime allies to halt an offensive he pledged to end. Trump put his signature on Wednesday on the Memorandum of Understanding to end the war, as did Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian, bringing it into effect 2 days earlier than previously expected. It calls for the immediate opening of the Strait of Hormuz and lifting of a U.S. blockade of Iran's ports. Though shippers say it will still take time for transit across the strait to reach pre-war levels, with a need to yet ensure safe access and clearer minds, there were immediate signs of an effect. Ships, which once might have concealed their positions by switching off their transponders, now broadcast their locations, poised to transit the strait. The U.S.-Iranian memorandum starts the clock on a 60-day negotiation period to reach a final settlement to the war, which Trump launched in February alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But Israel, which launched an invasion in March and since seized a large swath of southern Lebanon in its pursuit of Hezbollah militants who opened fire across the border in support of Iran, was excluded from the negotiations. Iran has always said any peace deal must also cover Lebanon. In an apparent major concession to Iran, the memorandum signed by Trump explicitly calls for the permanent termination of the war in Lebanon and for its territorial integrity and sovereignty to be ensured. With Lebanon among the peace effort's most delicate issue, Trump in recent days became openly critical of his allies' operations there, accusing Israel of unnecessarily destroying the entire buildings to hit Hezbollah fighters. Israel says it has no intention of withdrawing from Lebanon, whatever Trump negotiates. It released a new map Thursday showing an expanded southern area occupied by its troops. Two Israeli officials, including a senior official close to Netanyahu, told Reuters Israel was holding negotiations with the United States to keep Israeli troops in Lebanon. The senior official described those talks with Washington as stubborn and said Israel would not back down. The other official said the outcome would depend on whether Trump decides to force the issue by threatening repercussions on Israel. While fighting in Lebanon tamped down at the start of this week when Trump first announced the deal was reached, it ticked up again over the past few days and continued Thursday morning after Trump's signature. Lebanese state news agency NNA said Israeli airstrikes on the southern Lebanese towns of Kfar Tebnit and Zebedin killed three people Thursday. Reuters reporters heard an Israeli drone flying low over Beirut and its southern suburbs. I'm going to move on here to the weather stories here in central Illinois. on the front page, we have a there's a headline reading, McLean County spared from major damage. Flash flooding reported after Wednesday's storms. And this is by Olivia Jacobs and Annie Wang of the Pantograph. And I'll begin. Predicting a summer storm can be challenging. Oftentimes in the first round of storms, we will see where it will drive the second round. It could stabilize the storm and make it less likely over that area, said Ben Dubois, a meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Lincoln. The thunderstorm that moved through central Illinois on Wednesday did not hit McLean County with as much severity as the forecast had indicated. Instead, it moved south, where tornado and wind damage was reported in Springfield and the Mattoon and Charleston area. Dubois said, several small-scale factors play into whether a storm is likely to form, including timing, frontal positions, boundaries, whether storm cells converge or separate, and whether the sun can emerge between storm cells. Meteorologists often can't predict those details more than a few hours in advance, but the ingredients are usually in place for summer, for thunderstorms days in advance, he said. And flash flooding proved to be among the most serious concerns in McLean County, with reports of water covering roadways in Lexington, Hayworth, Downs, Saybrook, and Bellflower, as well as the rural areas of Bloomington and southeast of Lincoln, according to the National Weather Service. Kathy Beck, director of the McLean County Emergency Management Agency, said rural areas saw the most significant flooding, but Bloomington and Normal fared well since it received less rain than surrounding communities. According to EMA reports, floodwaters ranged from 5 to 6 inches on several McLean County roads, prompting numerous road closures. Bloomington Normal received roughly 1.5 to 2.5 inches of rain. 2.9 inches of rain was reported south of the Central Illinois Regional Airport, 2.55 inches near Hudson, 2.99 inches near Hayworth, and the highest reported was 3.65 inches near Lake Clinton, Dubois said. It was flash flooding, so it's high for a little while, and then it starts receding, she said. The flooding was mostly cleared by 9 a.m. Wednesday, Beck said. Residents should avoid driving through standing water, as even shallow water can conceal damage beneath the road's surface and lead to washouts. If drivers encounter water covering a roadway, Beck advises they turn around and don't drown. McLean County has a mitigation plan that includes many rural communities as well as Bloomington and Normal, and is working toward infrastructure improvements to reduce future flooding risks, Beck added. Those improvements include widening or deepening culverts and installing larger drainage pipes. Although McLean County saw less damage than expected, but it was not entirely unscathed after Wednesday's storm. Beck said a large tree fell on Route 66 near Funk's Grove, forcing an overnight closure. The National Weather Service also received reports of semi-truck and RV rollovers and broken utility poles along U.S. Route 24 in the El Paso-Gridley area. Wind and tree damage was also reported in McLean and Shirley. Outside McLean County, 1-inch hail was reported in Armington. Wind caused damage in the Lincoln area, and downed utility poles and trees were reported in the Clinton area and parts of Woodford County, according to the Weather Service. Dubois said the Illinois River between Havana and Beardstown has been in the moderate flood stage for the last couple weeks from recent rainfall, but more locally, the Mackinac River near Congerville is currently cresting around 12.5 feet just below flood stage, which is 13 feet. Sugar Creek crested around 4.7 feet yesterday, well below flood stage of 11 feet, but it has since come back down, the meteorologist said. Those Wednesday morning storms were packing quite the punch off the west closer to Galesburg, where we saw pretty significant wind damage in a few counties. However, they did weaken as the cold air came in and helped stabilize things, sending the threat a little further south, he said. The morning storms definitely did play a role in where the afternoon and evening were kind of set up. The rest of the week is expected to be dry through at least Saturday, and temperatures will be a little cooler compared to the heat wave earlier this month, Dubalbai said. Temperatures are expected to reach the mid to high 70s on Friday and around 80 degrees on Saturday, with dew points predicted between 50 and 60, making for lower humidity. The next round of thunderstorms is expected to move across the region Saturday night and into Sunday morning. And finally, on the front page, we have a column here by Jack Alkire, The Cutting Board, with the headline, Regenerative Farming Leads to Simple Pan-Roasted Chicken. And I will begin this column. Culinary inspiration can come from anywhere. A recipe may be timely and festive, marking a certain time of year. It can be a memory of grandma's pancakes cooked in bacon grease. Perhaps you've found an uncommon ingredient and want to try your hand at a new dish from across the world. Or it could be even from a TV show like South Park. As I was wandering the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market the other day, I was having trouble finding produce that either A, I had not featured recently, or B, was something I could use to create a new cutting board dish. So, when I happened upon James Mailot and his chicken stand, I thought, heck, I've got this one in the back pocket for a while. Let's give it a go. Roll up your sleeves, folks, because this week on The Cutting Board, we're making pan-roasted chicken. James Mailot is originally from the East Coast. You can hear it in his Bostonian accent. A few years ago, he retired from his job as the vice president for a transportation company, and he and his wife moved to central Illinois, he said. My wife grew up in Carlock on a little family farm that has currently all been converted to organic ground, Mailot said, and I've been very interested in regenerative farming. This is their third year raising chickens for meat production. In recent years, there has been a push by both small farmers and consumers toward the organic and regenerative movement, he said. This is a small batch, a hands-on 100 birds at a time farm, Mailot said. The chickens are raised out in the sunshine, out in the air, and, you know, the air quality has a lot to do with it. The chickens are moved around every day to new pasture, so besides the locally sourced organic feed, Mailot feeds his chickens, they're also getting little bugs and insects like they naturally would consume, he said. You're raising chickens, they're fertilizing the ground, you keep moving them onto fresh ground every day, so the birds are getting a lot of nutrients and a very healthy diet, Mailot said. The chickens are processed at Central Illinois Poultry Processing in Arthur. Mailot's favorite preparation method is a whole smoked bird. He smokes them for hours on end at a low temperature, and while that sounds fantastic, I think the pan roasting method is more approachable. I purchased a package of thigh quarters from Mailot, which had the thighs and drums from one bird. That's neat because at a supermarket, you'd be getting parts of multiple different chickens who may have been varying sizes. Now, the original recipe calls for chicken seared on the stovetop and then roasted in the oven, served with a pan sauce of red wine and shallot. We don't want to overwhelm the natural flavors of the chicken. To start, we need to break down these leg quarters. There's a portion of the backbone still attached to the thigh that we need to remove. Take a sharp boning knife and find the joint connecting to the backbone. Make a few shallow cuts to expose the joint, then break it and cut away the backbone. Don't throw this out. You paid for it. Dang it. I have a bag in the freezer with chicken parts that I'll use to make stock and most likely chicken and dumplings when it gets cooler. Now, to separate the drum from the thigh, make a few shallow cuts on the top of the joint until you can see it. Then you should be able to work your knife through the joint and separate the two pieces. There you are, not too difficult. Next, salt the meat with the kosher salt and let it hang out in the fridge for at least 30 minutes, preferably an hour. Pan roasting requires a stainless steel pan, and I will entertain no objections. The pan must be able to go directly into the oven after cooking on the stovetop, and it must be able to create a fond, those little brown bits left over after roasting. This fond must be transported back to the stovetop to create a pan sauce. Basically, it needs to be the ultimate multi-use pan and the only material that can do all those things without needing special care like carbon steel or cast iron is stainless steel. Start with a cold pan and add your chicken pieces, skin down. Maillot's chickens are leaner than those found in the supermarket, so I should have added a bit of chicken fat or neutral oil to start, but it's okay. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Turn the stove and heat to the pan to medium high. The fat will start to render and brown the chicken. Be careful not to break the skin like I did. Once the skin comes up from the pan easily and in one piece, flip it and put the whole pan in the oven. If it's not fully preheated, that's fine. After about 20 to 25 minutes, depending on the amount of chicken you have and the meat's thickness, check the internal temperature using an instant read thermometer. Chicken is done at 165 degrees Fahrenheit, but the dark meat can take a little more heat, so don't worry about too much about going to 170 or 175. Once the chicken is cooked, return the pan to the stovetop. Please, for your sake and the liability of the pantograph, use oven mitts. Remove the chicken from the pan and let it rest. Now, like I said, the original recipe calls for shallot and red wine, but I actually like sake and green onion better. It's lighter and brighter, something I think chicken should be. Pour about a fourth cup of sake into the pan and return the heat to medium-low. Using a wooden spoon, scrape up the fond left from the chicken and add the green onion, first the white bits and then the green. Once it's reduced by about half, add in a few pads of cold butter and either stir or shake until it's combined. This is one of the easiest ways to make a pan sauce. I added the chicken back to the sauce, let the two get familiar with each other, and this is a delicious, simple, and no-fuss way to have dinner on the table any day of the week. Just don't let your dog have any. And moving inside to more local news, we have a McLean County School story with the headline, Officials, Cell Phone Policies in Line with Law. District Rules Not Expected to Interfere with Pending Legislation. And this is by Drew Zimmerman of the Pantograph. Several McLean County schools districts are confident their existing policies related to cell phone use during school hours will not interfere with a pending state law cracking down on all wireless communication devices within schools. Senate Bill 2427, which passed out of both legislative chambers on May 31st and now awaits a signature from Governor J.B. Pritzker to become law, requires each school district in Illinois to adopt a policy prohibiting the use of wireless communication devices, including cell phones, during the school day. To help with this process, Illinois State Board of Education must publish a template wireless communication device policy by September 1st. Every parent and educator knows the damage that unchecked screen time and social media can do to our children and how disruptive they can be in school, Pritzker said in a news release. The bipartisan support for this effort reflects the urgency educators and families across Illinois feel. If a school district already has a policy in place that limits cell phone use during a majority or entirety of a school day, it may remain in place through the 2030 to 2031 academic year. At that point, a policy must be adopted that meets the requirements of the state statute. However, districts are not to enforce cell phone policies via expulsions, suspensions, fines, tickets, or citations. McLean County Unit 5 updated its cell phone policies last year to prevent devices such as phones, iPads, music players, or laptops from being used during instructional time. Exceptions to this rule include when a supervising teacher grants permission to use them for educational purposes, the use of the device is prohibited in a student's individualized education program, or the use is needed in an emergency that threatens the safety of the students, staff, or other individuals. Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel said, because the district's current practices already reflect many of the provisions of the legislation, staff does not anticipate a significant impact if it's signed into law. We will review the final bill and any guidance proposed by the state, but at this time, we believe our existing policy is already largely aligned with the new requirements, Weichel said. Nicole Rummel, Assistant Superintendent of Teaching and Learning for Bloomington District 87, said at the elementary and junior high levels, students within the district are already prohibited from using cell phones during the instructional day. At the high school level, the legislation allows districts to permit student access to cell phones during lunch and passing periods, which already aligns with District 87's existing approach. Feedback from high school staff has been positive, Rummel said. Teachers report that the current policy effectively supports classroom learning. Brian Quam, superintendent of Prairie Central Schools, said cell phones are to be kept in lockers for students up to the eighth grade. The high school policy allows students to have their cell phones, but they need to be put away or placed in a designated area in the classroom during instructional time. Like the legislation, Prairie Central students may use cell phones during passing periods or during the lunch hour. We're going to be evaluating this policy to ensure our compliance, but at this point we feel our policy is reflective of the new legislation, Quam said. Laura O'Donnell, superintendent of the Olympia Schools, said the district's cell phone policies were made last year. The district's policies prevent cell phones from being used at all within classrooms, and there have been positive impacts from that decision, she added. And next, we're moving on to a Bloomington Fire Department story with the headline, Death of Veteran Captain Mourned. And this is by Olivia Jacobs. The Bloomington Fire Department announced Captain James Schreiber died earlier this week after 29 years of service. Schreiber was off duty when he died suddenly Monday, June 15th, according to a news release from the department. His loss is deeply felt by every member of the Bloomington Fire Department and the community he served with distinction, the department said in the news release. Captain James Schreiber's presence will be sorely missed. He was a valued member of this department and a true public servant. May he rest in eternal peace. Schreiber began his career with the department on March 10, 1997. He was promoted to engineer on November 1, 2008, and he became captain on June 14, 2019. As a captain, he led his crew with wisdom, compassion, and an unwavering commitment to public safety, the department said. He was described as a pillar of the Bloomington Fire Department and an invaluable member of our fire service family. Fire Chief Corey Matheny said Schreiber was the very definition of what it means to serve. For over 29 years, he showed up for this department, for his crew, and for the citizens of Bloomington with integrity and heart. On behalf of the entire Bloomington Fire Department, I extend my deepest condolences to James's family and to every member of this department who is grieving alongside them. His memory will live on in everything we do. Schreiber received numerous awards throughout his career, including the Life-Saving Award, Unit Citation Award, Chief's Vision Award, and the Advanced Education Award. Funeral arrangements are being handled by Carmody Flynn Funeral Home in Bloomington. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 19th, and a funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 20th. And we also have a story here focused on the Woodford County Board with the headline, Member Wants to Improve Salary Negotiation Process. And this is by Steve Stein for the Pantograph. The Woodford County Board last month approved a 28% salary increase for the county's three elected officials following the November 3rd election. The approval came after the officials pressed the board for a larger pay hike than what was proposed by the board's three-member salary negotiating team, following what the officials called decisions made by previous boards that resulted in substantially lower pay for them than other county employees. During Tuesday's county board meeting, negotiating team member Dave Meinhold said a board meeting is not the appropriate time or place to negotiate salaries. To improve the process, he wants to see more board members on the negotiating team and a greater understanding by the board of what goes into decisions about salaries, which comprise 50% of the county's budget. The salary determinants include Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund anti-pension spiking measures that can negatively affect the county and employee and systemic differences on how county employees' salaries are set. Some salaries are set by the state. Some are set by union contracts and some are set by resolutions. It's a mixed bag, he said. And it's important to recognize that the salaries for our elected officials are set for the position, not an individual. I aim for fairness when it comes to salaries, fairness for the employee, the set county, and our residents, he said. County Board Chairman Chuck Nagel and Board Member John Krug are also on the negotiating team. Melissa Andrews, Dawn Kupfer, and Lynn Gilbert, the county treasurer, clerk, and recorder, and circuit court clerk, respectively, each will be paid $107,588 for the fiscal year that begins December 1st. The salary proposed by the negotiating team was $93,961, the result of a 6% pay increase plus a 6% cost of living increase. Andrews called the negotiating team's salary proposal a slap in the face at last month's board meeting. Andrews and Kupfer are running unopposed for a four-year term November 3rd. Gilbert is halfway through her four-year term. She was elected in 2024. The three will receive 4% annual raises for the rest of their terms, plus an annual $6,500 stipend from the state. In other news from Tuesday's board meeting, the county's new animal control building is expected to be delivered to its site in rural Metamora on July 6th, to Chief Deputy Sheriff Dennis Tipsward told the board. Infrastructure work at the site has been delayed because of the recent heavy rains, but the project remains on budget, Tipsward said. This month, the National Weather Service recertified Woodford County as a storm-ready community for 4 years. We're one of only about 35 to 40 counties in the state out of 102 to have the designation, said Kent McCandless, director of the Woodford County Emergency Management Agency. The county first received the designation in 2015. The Woodford EMA led the response last week after a tornado hit the Washburn area. 28 structures were examined by an NWS field team, which discovered that 3 were destroyed, 7 sustained major damage, and 10 had minor damage. No injuries or deaths were reported. The tornado came out of nowhere, McCandless said. There wasn't even a severe thunderstorm warning at the time. A special use, and we have some more other business here, a special use request by Austin and Kate Evans to utilize a residential building as a retail space on weekends was approved. Agricultural products such as meats, eggs, and produce will be sold in the home's breezeway. The building at 2696 County Road, 600 North, in El Paso, is on 36 acres in an agriculture district. No one is living there, no public restrooms will be provided for customers, and a sign on the building will announce the business. And finally, we have, let's see, in other news, the county will provide 20% of the funding for an approximately $1.5 million project to replace a bridge on Shum Road, which is County Road 1875 East, in Oleo Township between Congerville and Secor. The state will pay for 60% of the project, with the county and township splitting the remaining 40%. Maurer Stutz of Peoria will be paid an additional not-to-exceed cost of $3,985 for engineering work on a bridge replacement on County Road 1200 East. An agreement to pay Maurer Stutz a not-to-exceed $144,000 for engineering work on the bridge was approved in March 2025. And finally, the board reappointed Kristen Fair and Eric Scroggs to the Mentally Deficient Persons Board, Robert Segerman to the Secor Fire Protection District Board, and Robin Strauch to the Lynn Mount Vernon Cemetery Association Board. John Schick was appointed to the Panther Creek Drainage District Board. And finally, I'll do a brief McLean County Courts story. This is second Chittix teacher arrested. A second Chittix Junior High School teacher has been arrested in McLean County facing allegations of inappropriate conduct with minors. Andrew M. Miller, 40, whose last known address was listed in Normal, was arrested about 1:15 p.m. Wednesday, facing 42 felony charges, Bloomington police said. 40 of those are related to possession of child sex abuse material, charged as a mix of Class 2 and 3 felonies. He also faces one Class 3 felony, count of indecent solicitation of a child, and a Class 4 felony count of grooming. He is the second Chittick's teacher to face allegations involving inappropriate behavior with children. I'm going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Pantograph for Friday, June 19th shortly. Stay tuned.